This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Rufaro Manyepa.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
Wuhan coronavirus continues to spread. It has infected somewhere north of 60,000 people. It's killed over 1,400 people already. We've talked about some of the economic effects this disease may bring, but it may also have some dramatic geopolitical effects. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yes, before we get to the virus that's been just getting worse and worse, I think it's important to know that even before the outbreak, Chinese President Xi Jinping had already been under serious pressure from several directions. Over the last year, we saw his tightening grip on Hong Kong push the city into open rebellion that he's really not been able to suppress for close to a year now. We've also seen the curtain kind of pulled back on his human rights abuses of Chinese Muslims in Xinjiang. And that's really provoked the wrath of Europeans and Americans and many others around the world. And then Xi Jinping's efforts to squeeze Taiwan into submission ended up propelling the Taiwanese president, who ran on an anti-China platform, to a landslide victory. So that totally blew up on him. And then Xi Jinping's defiance of international trade law and his failure to manage U.S. President Donald Trump ended up causing China's largest customer to wage a tariff fight that took a considerable bite out of the Chinese economy. So these were all factors that were placing a considerable strain on Xi Jinping, but all of them really pale in comparison to this new strain of coronavirus that broke out late last year. The death toll now, if you go by the official numbers, is close to 1,400, with about 64,000 infected in China. And that's, you know, as I said, if you go by the official numbers, which are almost certainly being downplayed and minimized by the government there. But whatever the true numbers turn out to be, the economic impact on China has been deep. We mentioned this last week. You've got two-thirds of the economy still shut down, about 80% of manufacturing, and that's putting real pressure on economies around the world, but it's especially hitting China. You know, their GDP growth is taking a serious hit. It's on pace to be the lowest in about 30 years. And this economic downturn in China poses a threat to Xi Jinping because he is a dictator and he has kind of an unwritten contract that he's made with China's 1.4 billion people. It basically says if they will grant him full political power, then he'll make them rich and he'll make China a superpower. So that's the deal. And Xi Jinping is really falling short on his half of it right now. You know, those other factors with Hong Kong and things like that were already exposing the fact that he was falling short. But now with the coronavirus, it's at a whole new level. You've got quite a lot of real desperation in China. I think that desperation was pictured probably most heartbreakingly in some stories that came out over the last week about people risking their lives to get across a river from a quarantined city to a non-quarantined city. Just, you know, trying to cross this terribly polluted and violent current of a river so that they could earn a few yuan, basically, to feed their families. So it's just a terrible act of desperation. And many Chinese are coming to see that a fair amount of all these intensifying problems are the result of Xi's focus on kind of saving face and his focus on self-preservation above the preservation of the Chinese people.
It's a fascinating development. In our February edition, we were talking about the problems with human governments and looking particularly at what is happening in China as a parable of the problems with authoritarianism generally. And you could see this leading a few different directions, I guess, depending on how this virus plays out, but you add up all of these other factors that you were describing. What is it about the coronavirus, the government's handling of this particular crisis, that has made it vulnerable to these kinds of accusations?
Well, it's mostly that in the early days of this virus, when there were first whispers about it in December, Xi Jinping's Chinese Communist Party detained journalists who were covering it. And even more recently, they've detained journalists who they feel have tried to expose the true scope of it, which is beyond the officially reported numbers. There are reports that they have arrested citizens who have posted about the true scope of the disease. But there was a huge blow that came from the death of Dr. Li Wenliang. He was a doctor right there in the heart of Wuhan when the virus broke out in early December. And he posted on Chinese social media, just basically in a group of other doctors who he had gone to school with. And he said, there's a mysterious new virus. It doesn't seem to be responding to normal treatments. And rather than giving him a platform from which to kind of warn the country, the CCP knocked on his door a few days after he posted those things. They strong-armed him into signing a statement that said all of his warnings were false and that he apologized for destabilizing society. But the warnings were not false. And Dr. Li ended up dying of the coronavirus last week. And his death really sent shockwaves throughout China that I think are probably pose the biggest threat to the Communist Party since 1989 with the Tiananmen Square uprising. It was shocking to me to see Chinese social media suddenly full of outpourings of anger toward the government. The hashtag of the hour was "We want freedom of speech," because that's what Dr. Li had been deprived. The government was too concerned about preserving itself to want to kind of give any sort of ear to these very legitimate warnings. And so when he died, the people saw that there was this shameful attempt to silence this early warning that very well could have helped the country to contain this outbreak before it became so devastating. And I think that the damage that's doing to Xi Jinping and to the Chinese Communist Party is considerable. It's eroding a measure of public trust.
Mm-hmm. So you spoke at the beginning about this kind of unwritten contract between the dictator and the 1.4 billion Chinese, that they'll give him their devotion, full power, as long as he's able to make them a superpower and increase their wealth and so on. You said he's falling short, but he has done a remarkable job of bringing China into superpower status, so much so that a lot of people have been looking at China as being the superpower of the future, and that it's essentially we're looking at the next century as being dominated by China. Something like this really could compromise that to a degree, which is interesting given what we understand about prophecy. We've pointed a lot to, and our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has pointed to Vladimir Putin and Russia as being, prophetically speaking, the senior partner in this Asian alliance known as the Kings of the East. It seems that this could pave the way for Russia to reassume ascendance in that alliance.
That's an excellent point. That axis that Xi Jinping's China has formed with Vladimir Putin's Russia, it really stands out as one of this century's defining geopolitical developments. And most analysts, just because of China's colossal economic power, even its political and military power, they've almost always seen China as the senior partner and Russia as the junior partner. But as you said, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Russia and its president will come to dominate that Russia-China axis. Even though Russia's population and its economy are so much smaller than China's, and he's said that because of Bible prophecies. Prophecies that Mr. Fleury has said show that Putin will be in charge of this end-time Asian power bloc called the Kings of the East. So the Trumpet has been expecting some kind of shift to happen that would reduce Xi's power relative to Putin's, and that would allow for the kind of dynamic that Mr. Fleury has been saying what would happen. And, you know, we don't know exactly what will happen with this coronavirus. Maybe it'll be contained in the next few weeks. But I think that even in the best case scenario, if it all went away tomorrow, Xi Jinping will not emerge from this entirely unscathed. And China's economic might is suffering, and its political clout is being reduced to a degree. And meanwhile, Russia is virtually untouched by the disease, and Putin has just set this plan in motion to let him rule Russia for life, kind of behind the scenes right now. So the power balance in that Russia-China axis is shifting, and it's happening in the way that we've been expecting.
Well, Jeremiah has an article about this that is going up on thetrumpet.com. Will China's coronavirus make Vladimir Putin king of the East? Go check that out. And also Gerald Flory's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that explains those prophecies that underpin that forecast that it will be Russia that will be the senior partner in that alliance. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. 2 weeks ago, U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his Middle East peace plan. There was immediate opposition, but it's turning out not to be as serious as it looked at the beginning. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
This Tuesday, there was a Palestinian delegation led by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the UN Security Council, and he was coming there along with his delegation to oversee a vote that was meant to denounce President Trump's deal of the century that he rolled out towards the end of January. And what's interesting about this is that the vote did not take place at all. You might have seen on your TV screens Mahmoud Abbas giving a speech at the Security Council talking about how horrible this deal was. But that was kind of the only action that he was able to achieve there just because of the United States pressure on those members of the Security Council in the couple of weeks preceding this vote to really try and get support for the deal itself, and to pressure or encourage, whichever way you see it, the 15 members of the Security Council to vote against the Palestinian, let's say, the anti-Trump deal of the century.
When the Trump administration first unrolled this deal, we talked about just how much opposition there was to it among European leaders. Certainly the Palestinians were opposed to it. The Vatican was opposed to it. It seems like some of that that opposition is already dissipating.
Yeah, it certainly has, especially considering this vote that didn't even get passed. I mean, at the UN, with this Security Council resolution, what happened was it was introduced by Indonesia, and I think it was also introduced by Tunisia. They were drafting this agreement or this resolution that was meant to denounce President Trump, denounce deal of the century, and all these other things. And over the past 2 weeks, what you had is this high-pressure campaign from the Trump administration on the draft itself, to the point that President Trump's name was no longer in it. Deal of the century was no longer in it. It was just this kind of this ethereal resolution that was meant to declare that we still want the Palestinians to have their state and what have you. And so that's why the Palestinians removed it. And that it wasn't just the language that was changed. And that wasn't by the United States. It was by the framers of this agreement, of course, with the United States of this resolution. It was done under United States pressure. But you've got to remember that this group, this Security Council, is 15 members. All you've got to do to get a resolution passed, if it's not vetoed by one of the five permanent members, of which the United States is one, is get 8 members to pass it. And the Palestinians would have been happy with getting 8 members to pass this, pass a stronger resolution against the United States and force the United States to show that it needed to use its veto. At least then it would show the United States is isolated from the rest of the international consensus. But they recognized that that wasn't going to happen because you had so many members, most of them, many of them European, on this group that were not willing to say that the Trump deal was bad. And this came out also about 2 weeks ago, just after the deal was announced, when the European Union came together and the head of the EU Foreign Office was trying to get consensus among European nations to give a joint statement condemning the deal. It couldn't be done. There were European nations that weren't willing to go against President Trump's deal. And so they decided that, well, at least the foreign minister there of the EU, put out his own statement because he couldn't get an EU statement together. So I think that's interesting. What's also interesting as well is the fact that you had three members of the Arab world there in Washington for the rollout of this deal, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, I think it was. Well, it wasn't Qatar, it was Oman. You had three nations that were there celebrating the rollout of this deal that the Palestinians didn't like. And so I think the Palestinians themselves are surprised as well that there isn't much support from the Arab world for their, or at least let's say support against this deal. The Palestinians expected that the Arab world would be against this deal, but they're obviously not. There was a spokesman, or at least a member of the Palestinian delegation, that said that there was an atmosphere of bitter disappointment among the members of the delegation who went to the UN with Abbas. The sense is that we're coming back with our tails between our legs. We were caught unprepared and we didn't properly assess the American pressure on the members of the Security Council. And then that same person said, we're still in shock from the cold shoulder we received from the Arab states, chiefly among them the Gulf states, the Emirates, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. And so the Palestinians are witnessing a sea change where they would normally receive unwavering support from the Arab world. Now the Arab world is scared to support the Palestinian cause against President Trump, or at least they see President Trump's deal as a way forward for Arab-Israeli peace.
So it seems like we're seeing this divide among a divide between what we could call the more obstructionist wing and the more pragmatic wing of people looking at this, both within the Palestinian population and even other countries looking at this, that the pragmatists are viewing this peace plan with some degree of optimism, or at least viewing it as the basis for negotiations. You wonder, given, say, what we have talked about, what Gerald Fleury has talked about over the years with the peace process being a wound for the Jewish state, if this might actually bring them back to the point where they are. I mean, you look at this plan itself, and it is conceding land for promises of peace. And you just wonder if this whole moribund peace process, nothing has really moved forward with this since Ariel Sharon evacuated Gaza unilaterally, essentially. If this might actually bring them back to the point where they are willing to make concessions. I mean, you could look at the details of the plan. You could say, well, look, the Palestinians would have to make concessions in order to get to that point as well. But ultimately, it does come back to a land for peace deal.
Yeah, it does. I mean, yes, the Palestinians, as you say, would have to give up some things first. It wouldn't just be land and then peace. People say, we'll give up peace and then we'll give you some land. But fundamentally, you are going to end up with this is a deal for a Palestinian state. This is a two-state solution that would have Palestinians controlling 70% of the West Bank. And I think you bring up a good point that, you know, it looked like because the Palestinians were so obstructionist and because the Arab world was on the Palestinian side and against Israel, that there would be no peace process going forward. Israel would just reject it. But now you have an American that is pro-Israeli that has come up with a peace proposal that the Arab world is actually willing to look at. And I don't think Mahmoud Abbas would be willing to look at it. Maybe right. His tenure is going to be pushed aside. There's even some Palestinians that are saying that it's about time that happens. And so I wouldn't be surprised going forward. We see this leader of the Palestinians for so long who just follows after the ilk of Yasser Arafat being moved aside by more of the business wing of the Palestinian Authority that are willing to go negotiate with the United States, that is going to put the pressure back on Israel. Mm. That's where it will put it. Is Israel actually willing to give the Palestinians a Palestinian state next to them? I mean, so many of the Israelis are against this deal because Palestinians would end up with a state alongside them. But most Palestinians are happy that it's come up because they don't expect it to get that far, mm-hmm. that the Palestinians would actually get a state. But what happens if you do see the Palestinians come to the table under different Palestinian leadership? It would then create this situation where the deadly wound that Mr. Fleury's talked about for decades comes to the fore once again, where it hasn't for so long. The deadly wound is this peace process that Israel is negotiating with the Palestinians that is prophesied to come up to a greater deal. And the fact that, you know, the Trump deal has some support, it looks like we'll be talking about this for some time in the future.
Well, it certainly will be fascinating to watch this unfold. What happens going forward with this plan on the table and receiving a certain amount of support from unlikely sources? Brent has written an article about this. It should be up on the website soon, if it's not there already. United States Diplomatic Resurgence on show over Deal of the Century. And he talks about some of the details regarding this latest sequence of events. But I'd also encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of Jerusalem and Prophecy and look again at that chapter on Judah's wound. It's, as we were talking about, it's a prophecy that Gerald Fleury drew a lot of attention to back when the peace process was in full swing and you had regular meetings between, say, Yasser Arafat and an Israeli prime minister. And we talked about it a lot when Ariel Sharon was in power and he was making some of the moves that he made. But it's been a while since we had this kind of momentum behind any kind of a real peace initiative trying to resolve these issues over the negotiating table. So definitely something to look at, and that prophecy may show itself to be far more relevant in the time ahead as this deal continues to move forward. So thank you for that, Brent. Politics, as usual, are being disrupted in nations across Europe. This week, the trend hit Ireland. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a really remarkable story. So the political wing of the terrorist group, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, came out basically in joint first place in the Irish, the Republic of Ireland elections. Before I get into the details, I think it's important to understand who we are talking about here when we're talking about the IRA. You know, this is a terrorist group that killed more people than Al-Qaeda did on 9/11, you know, that targeted civilians, that did terrorist attacks on the streets of London, tried to kill innocent men, women, and children because they wanted to take over Northern Ireland against the will of the majority of the inhabitants. This is a terrorist group that worked around the world with other terrorist groups to kind of with mutually beneficial training arrangements and things like that, with Islamist terrorist groups, with people like Gaddafi in Libya, with the FARC terrorist groups in Colombia. So a truly evil organization that we are talking about. So even in the Republic of Ireland, you know, working with Sinn Féin, the political wing of this terrorist group, has been a taboo. All of Ireland's mainstream parties have, until now, refused to work with them, because of their history as basically a terrorist organization. It would be like working with Hezbollah or a political wing of Al Qaeda or something like that, or with the Muslim Brotherhood. So they've avoided them. But after this weekend's election, that's looking less and less possible. Now, Ireland has a really complicated electoral system with a first preference and second preference votes and all this kind of thing. Within the first preference vote, Sinn Féin came first with 24.5% of the vote. And then in terms of seats in parliament, Fine Gael, the Republican Party, they came in first with 38 seats. But one of those seats is for the House Speaker, who's kind of a neutral party, and he's not—he doesn't really count. So pretty much, Sinn Féin with their 37 is tied for all effective purposes with Fine Gael, this other party. So joint first place. And I think even Sinn Féin was shocked by this. They didn't even run in all the constituencies in Ireland. They're kind of a smaller party. If they had run everywhere, they probably could have done even better. So this is a pretty shocking result for Ireland. And basically now you've got the choice that so many other people have been facing in Europe that rocked Germany last week, where these two mainstream parties have probably either got to get together and form a left-wing, right-wing coalition, which, given that these two parties fought a civil war against each other back in the 20s, the 1920s, that's going to be difficult, or they compromise and work with Sinn Féin. Now, there is a small chance that Sinn Féin will be able to work with some of these other, some independent parties, independent politicians. They might be able to cobble together their own majority without either of the mainstream parties. That does seem unlikely, the math on that, but it's a possibility. So you've got this situation now where either you invite a terrorist into government or you have two historic enemies in government, and it's the same spiral that's led to massive dysfunction all across Europe, but with the added terrorist aspect of this, and you're now going to see a renewed push potentially to break Northern Ireland away from the United Kingdom.
So this is happening at an awkward time, right as Britain is extracting itself from the European Union, and you have this this pro-Catholic entity in Ireland that is rising in popularity. How much does this complicate matters for Britain at this time?
Yeah, I think there's some major potential dangers. I mean, one of the quotes that we end up keeping on coming back from Herbert W. Armstrong is when Britain joined the European Union, you know, he said, in all probability, this is going to be a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities. He saw that joining the European Union was going to be a bad thing for the UK. But also, it's not something that we can just close the door and walk away on easily. It's going to have some negative ramifications that keep moving on. And so you see now you've got Scotland pushing very hard for independence and wanting to go back to Brussels and rejoin the European Union. And you can be sure the EU will try and use them to cause a lot of trouble for Britain. And now you've got the potential for Northern Ireland to start to become a political issue in a way that it hasn't been recently. I think in some ways, the violence in Northern Ireland hasn't gone away quite. I mean, it's definitely gone down dramatically, but there's still been a low level of violence that is generally kind of kept at a low enough level. It hasn't really broken into people's consciousness within the mainland UK. But I think you could really see this get a lot worse. I mean, you've got Sinn Féin plays a role in the government in Northern Ireland. They're now, it looks like they could well play a role in the government in the Republic of Ireland. Their whole reason for existence is a united Ireland. So this is going to become a big political issue. And this is something that we warned about. The late Ron Fraser had quite a few articles back in 1998 when Britain and the terrorists, etc., you know, they signed the Good Friday Agreement, and the government under then Prime Minister Tony Blair basically decided, well, we're going to negotiate with the terrorists. And they sat down and did that. They came up with this agreement. And in that at that time, Mr. Fraser wrote that Sinn Féin and the IRA has always aimed to become a legitimate political force in the mainstream, gaining acceptance by established governments, the international community, and the public within their home states, and thus to win power by political means, which they started out to gain by the tactics of terror. So that's exactly what they've been doing, and it, you know, back in that article, even he talked about the way that the calculation behind Sinn Féin and the IRA's decision to sign this peace treaty. You know, they saw the way the demographics were going, they saw the way that, you know, the Catholic population of the North was increasing, the Protestant population was decreasing, and they figured, well, if we just wait it out, then eventually we're going to have a Catholic majority in Northern Ireland. And we're pretty close to that tipping point now, with only 42% as Protestant, 41% as Catholic. It's come a long way since 1998. And so you can see how they can get what they want now by sitting and doing nothing. Mr. Fraser had another article called Terror Triumphant, where he wrote that the Good Friday Agreement is at its best is a most shameful capitulation to the forces of terrorism. At its worst, contains the sinister seed of destruction of the very peace that it is touted to produce. And then when you think about the long-term forecast, or the main forecast that we make for Britain and Europe, and Mr. Armstrong gets back to this in his article that he wrote back in 1973, where the European Union is prophesied to become this superpower that's led by a church, that's led by the Catholic Church. So you're going to have this Catholic-led superpower, and it's being God is right allowing this power to rise up to punish Britain. And now you've got a Catholic Ireland that is voted in this, you know, this very Catholic party that has an almost religious mission to push the British out of Ireland and has violently confronted them. That's a really powerful tool for the Catholic Church to use and for Europe to use against the rest of the UK. So I think with this victory for Sinn Féin, you can see the European Union gaining a really potential weapon, a powerful weapon that they can use against the UK. And then, you know, there are a lot of intriguing prophecies about Ireland that talk about, you know, Ireland in biblical prophecy is Dan. And that indicate that this European power could even use Dan, could use Ireland as part, as a very major part of its attack on the UK. So, you know, Brexit happened just a month ago, or less than a month ago, 2-3 weeks ago. And then to have this lining up now with Ireland, I think really shows that world events, you know, could be lining up very quickly for that confrontation between Britain and the UK. And, you know, Mr. Armstrong forecast Brexit. He forecast that Britain would leave the EU. That's happened. He was right about that. But he also talked about this confrontation that's coming next. And I think you can already see that confrontation building and that he was right about that as well. And if you want to learn more about this whole story, that article by Mr. Fraser, From Terrorists to Politicians, is a great place to go to learn more about this story.
We also have an article by Daniel DeSanto coming on the website soon. What does Sinn Féin surge mean for the UK? You can check that out as well. Thank you for that, Richard. U.S. President Donald Trump released his budget proposal for fiscal year 2021. And if you believe America needs to be more responsible with its spending, you're not going to like it. For this story, we'll turn to Rufaro Manyepa.
Yes, sir. President Trump did release the 2021 fiscal year budget. And this budget actually shows an increase in spending over the course of the next year. Under it, the federal government would spend about $4.8 trillion throughout the course of the year. And just to put that into perspective, that's 21% more than when President Trump took office. It's been an increase of about $850 billion from the time that he came into office and until now. And it's really just increasing the already heavy burden of the U.S. debt. And it's not going to get any better, because according to the statistics right now, with the spending that's projected for this year and how it's going to be going, it won't be reducing the budget deficit that the United States has. Right now, it has a $1 trillion deficit. And according to projections by the Congressional Budget Office, this deficit is going to stay well over $1 trillion over the next 10 years. As a matter of fact, by 2030, it's projected to be at around $1.2 trillion. So you can already see that.
$1.2 trillion deficit in a single year.
Yes, sir. And it's despite the fact that the U.S. economy is growing. In 2017, the economy grew by 2.4%, in 2018 by 2.9%, and in 2019 it was 2.3%. So despite the fact that the U.S. economy is growing, this deficit isn't going to be shrinking, because the spending just continues to be more and more astronomical. Right now, with this new budget proposal, there's going to be an incredible increase of spending in the military, in defense, and in border security as well. And there isn't a corresponding decrease in anywhere that's realistic. The only places that have slated budget cuts right now are in areas such as the reduction in amounts for domestic policies like food stamps and Medicare, things that right now this proposed budget really probably won't have any cuts allowed for that in Congress. And so you can already see that everything that the Trump administration has been doing, despite the booming economy and the really, really rich amounts of money that have been coming into the United States, there is a serious problem as far as the economy is concerned. The amounts that the United States government are spending just do not work. And when you look at the debt, the way that it's just continually rising, nothing is being put in place right now to make this debt situation become any better.
So you would hope that if there were anyone in Washington who really wanted to get American spending under control, to take responsibility for America's fiscal house, that it would be a Republican president when you have a Republican majority in the Senate. But that isn't happening. In fact, Donald Trump famously said he called himself the king of debt, and he said that he's actually done very well with debt over the years. So this is really the kind of thinking that we're seeing behind the budget that he's presenting to Congress.
That's exactly the case. You look at this proposal right here, and it really looks like a matter of kicking the can down the road. You know, they're talking about how they anticipate that in about 10 years, the consistent growth to the U.S. economy is going to catch up to the way that the debt is growing, and eventually it's going to cause the debt to start going down and the fiscal deficits to get balanced out. But this really does show that the American economy is on really unstable footing, and the growth and prosperity that it's currently having right now. We've spoken a lot about the temporary resurgence that the United States is having. It's really masking a lot of problems in the economy. It's really masking a lot of the trouble that's going to come down the road, because if we do actually end up having a recession, all these policies that are in place right now are just going to crumble, because every single dollar that is on this new budget proposal is predicated on the belief that with the low interest rates that are being placed right now on the financial sector, all these increases in money, it's all expecting that it's going to hold. But when you have that recession finally hit America with the low interest rates that are in place, with all these monies that are being paid for without anything to really back it up, you're going to see the American economy just fold and crumble very, very quickly. That's the main problem with this kick the can down the road approach to the economy. Right now, it's working because everything is growing and the economy is flourishing right now, but it's not based on anything. Mm. And when the time comes that you need something to fall back on, it's not going to have a single thing.
Well, very interesting. We've been talking about the inevitability of an economic collapse in America for quite some time. We haven't seen anything on the scale of what we saw back in 2008. Since then, we've been in perpetual growth mode ever since then. But an inevitable day of reckoning is definitely coming. We would like to direct listeners to an article that trumpet writer Robert Morley wrote back in February 2017, our print edition from a few years back. When Donald Trump first took office, he was talking about what his policies would have were going to do for the nation. We've seen some of the things that he talked about playing out. So we'll put a link to that article in the show notes. Thank you, Rufaro. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, war between Turkey and Syria, the possibility of France sharing its nuclear weapons with Germany, satellites stalking other satellites, and public schools getting rid of grades. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A hot war is heating up between Turkey and Syria, one that could create more waves of migrants and more crises for several nations. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brenton Octagal.
While it's easy for people to forget about the Syrian civil war since it's gone on for 9 years, it is kind of critical that we put our attention to it right now, because it is entering a new phase with the state-on-state violence or war that's taking place between Syria and Turkey. Now, to get to this point, this has been going on basically for about 2 weeks, and you've had a couple hundred Syrian soldiers die, and you've had maybe a few dozen or a couple of dozen Turkish soldiers die in this battle. And before now, you haven't really had Turkey and Syrian forces battling it out. It's mainly been Turkey's proxy in Syria fighting against Assad's men. to about or in middle of January, you had a new offensive that was started by the Syrians with Russian air power backed by the Iranians into the final enclave that had rebels. And this is the infamous Idlib province. It's got about 3 million people in it. And this is one of the safe zones that Turkey and Russia agreed to, I guess it was back in 2018, where they said that, well, you can protect everybody in this area. This is where the refugees will go. This is an area that is against the Assad regime. But to prevent a total catastrophe where millions of people more, or a lot of more people are dying, we'll give you this little area. And Turkey was allowed to guard it. They were allowed to bring their forces in south of their border to guard it. What's happened over the past 2 months is that, according to the Iranians and the Syrians, Turkey hasn't done a good enough job at preventing this area, this safe zone, as being used as a safe haven for terrorists that are fighting against the Syrian regime. And so they decided, the Syrian regime did, that we are going to go into Idlib province. They've taken over about 25% of that in the past month and a half, to the point that they started actually attacking Turkish positions as the Turks were trying to prevent their incursion. And so now we're having state-on-state violence. Now, some of the things that could come from this is the fact is another massive wave of refugees. Over 750,000 to 1 million people have been displaced in the past 6 weeks inside Idlib province. They're pushing towards the Turkish border. Turkey doesn't want to let them in. They've already got 3.5 million Syrian refugees inside their nation's borders. And then you've got the pressure from the Europeans for Turkey to ensure that those refugees they currently have don't make their way to Europe. So right now there's heads, you know, you've got the Russians talking to the Americans, talking to the Turks, who are talking to the Syrians, the Russians talking to the Syrians to try and stop this. Germany's foreign minister just came out today saying to the Russians, hey, you need to stop Syria's advance on Idlib province. It is a humanitarian catastrophe, and it's going to threaten migrant flows again into Europe. And so we haven't heard much about this for, let's say, 2 or 3 years, 2015, 16, when the migrants were pushing into Europe. But unless Syria stops what it's doing right now in Idlib province, it looks like we're going to have a return to massive migrant flows into Turkey and perhaps into Europe as well.
The idea of another wave of migrants flowing out of Syria, this has to be striking fear in European capitals, especially Germany. When you think about the migrant crisis, that was really a huge part of what compromised Angela Merkel's strength as chancellor in Germany. And right now they're going through quite a leadership crisis. So you mentioned these different capitals that are trying to come to some kind of an arrangement of what to do about this. What's Russia's stake?
Well, obviously Russia is a backer, or has been, of the Syrian regime, and they have participated, at least on the early stages of this incursion. Although it seems like Assad is probably going further than the Russians would want, because Turkey isn't going to back down. It can't back down from fighting against the incursion of the Syrian forces, as it needs to prevent or needs to keep a lot of these people inside Syria rather than in their borders. And so Russia has been relatively mute on condemning Turkey. Turkey has been shooting down or killing tank, shelling artillery, using artillery against Syrian positions, and Russia hasn't really spoken up against what Turkey's been doing. And so maybe Russia is starting to kind of recalibrate its position in Syria. It wants to stay in Syria in the long term. It doesn't really care if Assad has to go. And so what we've expected, based on a prophecy in Psalm 83, is that through these dealings with Europe wanting to get involved and Russia there as well, and even Turkey, who is a NATO member, a European ally, getting more heavily involved, is that we are going to see the Iranian alliance with Assad really take a back seat to more of the sphere of influence come down from Turkey, Russia, and Europe. And so we expect, based on Bible prophecy, for the Iranian-backed Assad to lose power in this in the state of Syria. Whether Assad goes or not, we'll see. He's gonna, if he has to, for this prophecy to take place, he's definitely gonna have to change his allegiances away from Iran to more of this Turkey, who's willing to deal with Russia kind of side of things. So going forward, Syria is a complicated mess in so many ways, so many foreign actors are involved, but we expect Turkey's increased entrance there to force the issue perhaps with Russia to maybe sideline Assad going forward, or even the Iranian attempts now to push at Turkey in Idlib province.
Thank you, Brent. Thanks for keeping your eye on that situation for us. Is it possible that Germany could gain access to France's nuclear weapons? As European leaders work toward forging a unified military, the Germans are asking for exactly this. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, and this is not even the first time that Germans have brought this up. They obviously have something about getting European nuclear weapons. But it was just over a week ago, Johann Vadefall, he's the deputy chairman of the CDU Parliamentary Group for Responsibility for Foreign and Military Policy, so a senior parliamentarian for Germany's main right-wing party. He talked about France Europeanizing or NATO, using under NATO, their nuclear weapons. He said it's in Germany's interest that we can influence the nuclear strategy that protects us. And he said that France should put its nuclear forces under the joint command, either of the EU or NATO. I think, you know, Germany making this request knows that Emmanuel Macron has very recently called NATO brain dead. They're throwing this out there to just make it look like, well, we don't have a European agenda. We just want anybody to share these weapons. But really, it's a push, I think, to get these weapons under European control. And he basically called out Emmanuel Macron. He said, well, look, you've pushed for a unified military. You've lectured Germany even on how we need to do more and pay more. Well, what about France making some sacrifices as well and putting those nuclear weapons under a European, some kind of European command? That in itself, Germany making that request, is really interesting. And I think France's response was interesting as well. They didn't say yes, but at the same time, I don't think it was a completely firm no either. They talked about having strategic dialogue on the role of nuclear deterrence in our common security. And so basically saying, well, let's talk about it and talk about maybe having other EU countries participate in exercises by the French armed forces on nuclear deterrence. So they're not saying, yeah, sure, we'll let you have our nukes tomorrow. But they are opening a dialogue on this kind of a subject, and maybe with the right kind of incentives. And if they get something in return, it would have to be something pretty big. But if they get something in return, they'll Europeanize these weapons. But this is an important story to watch, just Germany working with France and France empowering Germany. This was the subject of an article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flowey in the very latest Trumpet print edition. France is resurrecting the Holy Roman Empire is the title. And you know, we've been forecasting the rise of this European power, and the Bible makes very clear that France is going to be a part of it. And when you look at world events, you see France turning its back on some of its main traditional allies, Britain and America, and empowering Germany. Now you've got this potential for France empowering Germany on even a nuclear level. And you look at what the Bible prophesies for this Holy Roman Empire, and the idea of Europe having its own nuclear weapons is really something to keep watching, because the Bible says, well, this is going to be a superpower and a very aggressive one, and that its use of nuclear weapons, there are, you know, specific scriptures that talk about its use of nuclear weapons, that this new use of nukes is going to be a major stepping stone in the journey to the return of Christ to this earth, and just a key point in end time events.
All right, well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for that, Richard. A couple of Russian satellites have been getting unusually close to an American spy satellite. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, John J. Raymond is the chief of operations of the U.S. military's newly created Space Force, and he said on Monday that an American spy satellite is being trailed by two Russian satellites, and the Russians have navigated their satellites to within a dangerously close distance from this U.S. satellite. So we know that as a long-term goal, the Russians would like to be able to destroy American satellites, and especially those like this particular American one, which is up there to keep an eye, really, on Russia and other nations. But this particular pair of Russian satellites, they're only inspection satellites. So they're probably right now trying to deduce the U.S. satellite's camera aperture and its resolution, its computer functionality, and things like that, so that they can just kind of see how their own satellites measure up and possibly try to mimic some of the U.S. technology. But Bible prophecy does talk about a time on the horizon when the U.S. and some of its current allies will be besieged by Russia and some of its allies. Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 and Deuteronomy give details about that. And then there's a passage in Isaiah 59 that provides more information about it. It says, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes." And this is already true in a spiritual sense for the U.S. today. It's clear that the country is in spiritual blindness, but the kind of vision that's really absent in this prophecy could also include physical types, including that is provided by this American satellite. So I think in light of that prophecy, this story about this these Russian satellites tracking a U.S. spy satellite in its orbit is an important one for us to keep a close eye on.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Public schools are not what they used to be. They're revising curricula to include politically correct messages, trying to turn students into activists for environmentalism and racial equality and transgenderism. They're also trying to help kids' self-esteem by doing away with grades. To learn about this, we'll turn to Rufaro Manyepa.
Yes, sir. A few school districts in California and Wisconsin are revising the traditional grading system, the A to F grading system that's been used, and they're replacing it with a kinder, more gentle model for the students. For example, in the Madison Metropolitan School District in Wisconsin, they have replaced the traditional A to F grading system with one which features EX, M, D, V, or E. In this grading system, EX stands for exceeding, in which a student consistently exceeds grade level expectations for the end of the year. M stands for meeting, a student is consistently meeting grade level expectations. D is developing, a student developing understanding. And emerging is students beginning to show initial understanding. And this is
emerging. The worst grade that you can get is you're emerging.
You're emerging. It's definitely a gentler way to put it. And it's very optimistic, I think you could say, in a way, in which it's presuming that every child is on the way. But in reality, it's hiding the truth. It's doing away with reality. And children aren't being graded on reality, but on hope, on something that they hope the children will get to. And the problem with that is it ends up making it such that you never really do attain the actual goal when you're masking the true reality. You end up feeding just this lie that you're telling to the children so that you don't address the real problem which is at hand. And
I assume that they're basically they're implementing this in order to avoid hurting the kid's self-esteem, or you hand someone a C or a D or an F and you're basically telling them you're failing. Whereas if you say, well, you know, you're developing or you're emerging, a kid can do really poorly and still feel pretty good about themselves.
That's exactly the idea. You'd think that if you hear the fact that your child is emerging, that or the child hears that he or she is emerging, that sounds a whole lot better. And it's that sugarcoating to feed the children the idea that they're all equally brilliant, but they're developing it at different times. They have a different time scale for each one of them. And the problem with that is none of them actually correspond to the A through F scale or grading system. It's something that's just relative, and not even relative to the present sense, but it's all about the projected end of the year expectations, not the reality that's on the ground at present. They don't address even a specific class or subject. They're actually dealing with 40 different classifications, excluding things like mathematics and science, and instead talking about how the students tell a story or describe an experience or understand and identify stages in the life cycle of insects. It really does not do anything for a student in learning anything substantive in school.
So you get your child's report card, and the report card tells you that your child is an emerging storyteller and a developing student of the knowledge of insects.
That's basically it. And you don't really know how the child is performing in real things that matter in the real world, like science or English and mathematics. And it's really allowing for the school system to just take over in every aspect, and for all the education that happens of the child at school to really exclude the parents, because parents won't know what is really going on in the classroom, and the students are suffering. No student is going to benefit at all from being told that they're emerging, being fed lies about their performance, and not really knowing how they can actually improve. And that's what the school system is doing. It's really hurting the children, and it's not allowing parents any way of knowing how they can address the situation with their children.
Right. You could just imagine anyone who was performing any kind of a job that other people were depending on your performance. If you're out there in the real world and you're part of an engineering project designing a bridge or something, that if you failed on that job, that you would have to be told this was a failure before it endangered lives, rather than just being told, well, we'll just say that you're developing or something along those lines. Very dangerous thinking. It's easy to underestimate just how much of a disservice this is doing to our children. Thank you, Rufaro. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Rufaro Manyepa, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edward Clark: the best way to realize the pleasure of feeling rich is to live in a smaller house than your means would entitle you to have. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.